Oh, Jack.
When do you think that will be ready?
Do it just as quickly as we can.
I might say that's the kind of evasive question for which the UIW can become famous. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize for this ungodly hour. Blame it on the fact that I'm from the Midwest. My section of the Midwest, it's even an hour earlier than this. At a press conference that I held after my election as president of the UIW, I said the course of the UIW was not changed by the tragic loss we had. And we signaled to Black America that by my presence with Dr. Abernathy and Mrs. King in Atlanta last Saturday, that we stood with them in their battle for freedom. I said down in Atlanta to those of our 1,600,000 members who are not yet believers that their union, the UIW, cannot be a fully effective defender of their rights except as we have a free and democratic America. I'd like to say publicly today to Brown America, to signify our intention to stand with them in their battle for freedom, that on the 12th of June in Kennedy Square in Detroit, at which time a truck which has been purchased by the UIW and donated to the will be donated to the Farm Workers Organizing Committee, and on which will be mounted the bell for Delano, which was brought over from England, was bombed out in London, which is bound in chains and will not be released until they have won their strike, that will be the first of a series of rallies across the country to continue the boycott of grapes, but also now, with the last two contracts having been signed, to put emphasis on the fact that Americans can, in good conscience, eat grapes because 20% of the poundage is now under union contract. Cesar Chavez will join me in that rally in the late afternoon of June the 12th. We are also engaged in a series of meetings across the United States and Canada with our corporation councils, with our regional conferences, to mobilize our forces for the upcoming negotiations. And our determination in those negotiations has been not at all diminished. We join the top executives of the General Motors Corporation, Mr. Roach and Mr. Cole, who said to their stockholders in their annual report that in the 1970s, quote, we have every reason for optimism, and we will be bargaining with them, with Ford, with Chrysler, with the agricultural implement industry in the context of having every reason for optimism. Now we have the matter of the inflationary factor. Apparently, once again, we're going to go through that well-worn script that the whole cause of inflation in the United States is improper cost push caused by labor demands and labor realizations. But we stand again with a former president of the General Motors Corporation, Mr. C.E. Wilson, who said so many times across this country in 1949 and 1950 that it is not wages that push up prices, but prices that pull up wages. And we also want to tell this nation that it is a myth that the industrial worker has become part of the affluent middle class. An assembly line worker working straight time, and he's lucky today if he is working full straight time, makes less annually than $8,000. And even when you allow for the other solid benefits he has, such as fully paid and comprehensive health medical insurance, that is not sufficient to properly support a young and growing family. And of course, the actual money income of the industrial worker has been declining over months. We will specifically say in this year of 1970 to the automobile industry, and I am well aware of this, in 1955 I had the distinction to be the agricultural implement director for our union, and our campaign in agricultural implement in that year of 1955 was to catch up to the automobile industry. The skilled trades wage rates were 10 cents an hour behind, other things were behind. And it was quite a struggle to simply catch up. Today, the agricultural implement industry is far beyond in economic benefits the automotive industry. Despite the fact it's a lower profit industry, and despite the fact it is a competitor of General Motors, of Ford and Chrysler, in trucks, in earth-moving machinery, and in other goods. They get, for example, in agricultural implement, an extra week of vacation at 20 years. They get a $100 bonus on vacations, of which we get not one penny, $75 payable when the vacation is taken, $25 payable when a Christmas vacation is taken, because they get off the day before Christmas, stay off until the day after New Year's, and get paid for every working day, what would otherwise have been a working day during that period. In the Caterpillar Company, a direct competitor, I repeat, of General Motors and Ford, when a worker is laid off, if he has 1 year of seniority but less than five, he gets 3 weeks at full pay. Then he goes on SUB. If he has 5 years of service, up to 10, he gets 5 weeks at full pay. Then he goes on SUB. If he has more than 10 years of service, he gets 7 weeks at full pay. Then he goes on SUB. And they have voluntary overtime, whereas we have imposed servitude in the big three of the automotive industry, both in the United States and Canada. And for the most part, the agricultural implement companies pay substantially higher wages than do the big three. President Nixon said on the 17th of October, 1969, and I quote directly, that the rate of increases, referring to price increases, not only have slackened, but the rates of increases are actually down. Well, unfortunately for our country, that has not been the case. In the period from April 69 through October, period of which the president was speaking, the increase in the consumer price index had been 2.7%. In the 6 months that have gone by since the president gave us that message, October 69 through April of 1970, the increase has not been 2.7% or less, it has been 3.2%. However, we do agree with the president when he said on October the 17th, the blame for the spiral of wages and prices falls fundamentally on the past policies of your government. And he continued, the federal government spent a lot more than it raised in taxes. And that, of course, is still true. Current military spending, which I don't need to tell this sophisticated audience, not counting veterans' benefits, but counting the debt service on past military spending, fiscal year 71, 45.6% of the budget for a total of $91 billion. And we contend there are gross inefficiencies and mismanagement by the government and its contractors in the spending of that defense money. When we look at cost overruns on the C-5A of from $3.4 billion originally estimated to $5.2 billion, then we say that if the automobile industry were run in that fashion, that the automobile industry would be bankrupt. And we cannot avoid the fact that that same company that builds the C-5A, Lockheed, has on its payroll 210 retired military personnel who held the rank of Army Colonel or Naval Captain or above, out of a total of 100 defense contractors of 2,072, that we believe that the inefficiency and the mismanagement may have a direct relationship to that conflict of national interest. Now, we need to end the war in this country before we can meaningfully tackle our social problems. And I say that it is no dishonor to a nation. It is no dishonor to a nation when that nation is the most powerful in the world that it would make peace with small brown peoples and let them determine their destinies as we have always been determined we will make our destinies. And we then believe we would be in a position to use the magnificent capabilities of our defense industries, engineering, technological, and every other capability for conversion to meeting the social needs of our troubled nation. Are there any questions?
How do you do it?
As far as the automobile worker is concerned, the it's a mixture of things. There is a sore need for a substantial wage increase, and this goes beyond the 26 cents, which is already piled up under what we call the overage letter. And we say that that 26 cents belongs to 1967 bargaining. It's money that would otherwise have been paid had the old cost of living structure continued. Beyond that, there is a sore need for a substantial wage increase. At the same time, the demand for amending our pension programs to permit early retirement with 30 years of service, regardless of age, with a $500 minimum benefit, that this is a demand that has strong support in the ranks, not simply from those older in years, but also from those younger, because this goes back again to the question of security of tenure. Because as the older ones move out into service, then the security of those lower on the seniority list becomes more intent. And of course, that too relates to the appalling statistic which I read this morning, that in the young male black community in Detroit, the unemployment rate is 40%. If this nation thinks it can live safely in its cities with young male blacks being 40% totally unemployed, it is kidding itself. And then, of course, we are fully determined to restore cost of living in the shape that it was when initially it was voluntarily done in 1948 by the General Motors Corporation. Federal fiscal policies, widely unbalanced budgets, if it is true, if we are to be given a continuance of this most unfortunate war, then the taxing policy of the government should meet that problem and not try and have a wage policy which goes to only one sector of the economy. It doesn't go to even all workers. It just goes to the industrial workers who work in the massive corporations. It is in no way enforceable against any other sectors of the economy. It is grossly unfair. And it would not work. Our organization is absolutely opposed to that because, as I have just said, it is totally unfair. The question of price controls, for example, never goes to the question of should the General Motors Corporation in fact be required to reduce its prices because by virtue of increased productivity, wages being held in line, it gets a greater profit. It goes only to the simple question of continued additions to price. As I say, it goes only to the question, even the old jawboning techniques of the Kennedy administration went only to the large blocks of industrial workers working for the big industry. It did not go to the building trades with their localized markets. It did not go to all the scattered groups across the country. It is grossly unfair, but above all, it is unworkable.
Mr. Woodcock, how would you describe the confidence or the lack of it on the part of the UAW leadership and the rank and file in the Nixon administration in its ability to meet the problems of the day?
Well, let me say this, that our leadership, and I think in general our membership, always want to have confidence in the man who is the President of the United States. It gives no joy to us to have the office in any way diminished, because in our form of government, the faith in that man, the competence of that man, is so necessary to our national salvation. I must confess that our faith at the moment is sorely tried.
In what way?
Well, on the federal fiscal policy to which I just made reference, on the curious policy in Southeast Asia that we are getting out by getting in deeper. We are absolutely opposed, not only to the war, but certainly opposed to the widening of the war. And I am mystified why the president of the most powerful nation in the world can be vetoed by the president of South Vietnam on the question of moving out of Cambodia. Well, quite obviously, we have not taken a referendum. The relationship of the leadership of this union to the membership of this union, they weigh us first on what we do for them at the collective bargaining table. There are many of them who are with us. There are some of them who tolerate us because we do a good job for them in what is our basic responsibility. There are some who are absolutely opposed, because when you have 1,600,000 men and women across the United States and Canada, you have a cross-section of the American nation, so that we have all of the problems of the American nation inside our organization. But when we can't have a national election, roll call election, as we had in Atlantic City last April, and all the Southern delegates vote for a black man as a national officer of our union, which they did not do so readily a few years ago, I think our membership stands at a higher level of understanding than does the people generally. Of course, there have already been substantial disruptions in that industry. The economic situation in Southern California is very bad indeed. Just like in Michigan, it's much worse than the national average. The space program is contributing to that. The dislocations in defense spending is going to that. But the solution to that problem is not to pile on arms and force the Soviet Union to continue in the arms race. The solution to that is to use the magnificent capabilities of that industry to solve problems of mass transit, the whole traffic problem, air pollution, water pollution, and all of these things, which can only really be handled on a systems analysis basis. And that industry is the most magnificent exponent of the virtue of systems analysis of any industry that I know. And those capabilities need to be used for the social good, both nationally and internationally.
Mr. Woodcock, under your leadership, how do you see your relationship with the UAW, the rest of the labor movement, AFL-CIO, and the Alliance for Labor Action?
Well, first of all, the departure of the UAW from the AFL-CIO was not a personal matter with our late President Walter Reuther. We all joined in that decision. We were all supportive of that decision. We left because we thought we could better reflect the social needs of our membership on a separate basis. And in continuing that, we joined with the Teamsters Union in forming the Alliance for Labor Action. We will continue that. We will continue to work with the Teamsters, the chemical workers, the national distributed workers, and anyone else, any other organization that wishes to pursue the goals that have been set forth as the goals of the ALA. But in saying that, I want to make it crystal clear, as Walter Reuther made it crystal clear so many times, we are no enemy to any labor organization in the United States or Canada. We stand ready to work with any or all for any given end upon which we both agree.
Mr. Woodcock, the U.S. State Department,
Go ahead. I think we can fairly say to the automobile industry, number one, you should catch up to the agricultural implement industry as they caught up to you in 1955, and then we should move, since we'll be bargaining in the same time period, we should move the two together to a higher level.
Mr. Woodcock.
Well, I suppose it can be traceable to the fact that the principles were pioneered in the automobile industry because in point of time, they've always been a few weeks ahead of the agricultural implement industry. And I might point out that my colleague, Vice President Pat Greathouse, who is a most able negotiator, goes about this job quietly and for the most part without strikes, they've achieved these goals. It may be that the agricultural implement industries have a somewhat more enlightened management in these areas. But they can remain competitive to the big three. It's true they have, long run, a somewhat lower rate of profit, but they are profitable, they stay in business, and they do a job. Yes.
This is my question. The U.S. State Department is trying to renegotiate the U.S.-Canada automotive agreement. Just what is the UAW position on this?
First of all, with regard to the agreement itself, we are totally supportive of it. We think it makes a great deal of sense to have a common market between the United States and Canada. When this was first introduced, we were reaching an intolerable state of affairs where the trade deficit of Canada was running in the neighborhood of some $600 million, and it so happened that at that time, the trade imbalance as between our two countries in vehicles and parts was to Canada's disadvantage in that same area. Canada was beginning to take measures to protect herself, which was leading towards a possible trade war, which would be unthinkable between the United States and Canada. Now the problem is that in working out the treaty, Canada was given certain protections, certain guarantees as to the amount of production that would remain in Canada after the advent of the treaty in January of 1965. And that is the point at issue. I am not knowledgeable enough at this point to know whether the Canadian government is correct in asserting they still need that protection, or whether or not we could have a full manufacturer's common market. I might add, however, we are dissatisfied with that common market. We think it should be a customer's common market. I don't think that on this side of the river in Detroit, referring back to my hometown, that a Chevrolet should sell for $250 less than that same Chevrolet being sold across the river in Windsor. So that although it's a common market, it's a common market under the control of the manufacturers and not, as in the European sense, under the control of the customer.
Mr. Woodcock, President Nixon, last night at the White House with 40 business leaders. What are your thoughts on the timing of that meeting, and are you satisfied with the President's method of communicating with the people?
Well, I'm not seeking an invitation to the White House. I don't know what the tenor of the meeting was. I was somewhat intrigued by one direct quote from a New York banker, I think it was, who said it gave him new confidence to know that what he had read in the newspapers was also said by the President of the United States. Let me say I agree with Herb Locke's cartoon that's in the Washington Post today. I think it's unfortunate when a man who is a leader of all the American people should be identified properly with condemnation of violence by certain elements of our society on the left, but be silent with regard to the use of violence, mobilized, organized, possibly paid violence on the other side. I find that most regrettable. If the construction workers in their hearts as ordinary American citizens want to support the policy of this government as it is, obviously that is their right. But it is just as patriotic to be a dissenter as it is to be a supporter. I'd make no further comment. We can only understand productivity in relation to the economic factor on the basis of long-term trends. It is true we have been in a period of relatively low productivity. Certainly in terms of the automobile industry, I am positive we're going to pull out of it fast in the near future. The new assembly plant that General Motors is putting up in Lordstown, Ohio for the production of the mini car is using automated devices in the assembly of the car now to an extent they have never done before. They've used automation widely in fabrication and in stampings and so on, but never in assembly. That's been almost entirely a hand operation. They now have what is called the Unimate, an entire welding line is manned entirely by these machines with not one single person on the line. This is certainly going to have a sharp impact on productivity. Of course, unfortunately, we do not know what the productivity of any of the big three is because these are closely guarded secrets. It would be better if we could bargain on the basis of national productivity. But that means that if our economic bargain is less than the productivity of that company, then the difference should be translated into lowered prices for the total good. That does not happen. That's our problem today. 1958, administered prices of big industry continued to rise during a recession period. They're doing it now. And as long as that continues to be their pricing policy, we are determined to bargain with them on the conditions of that corporation and not on the national condition.
Mr. Woodcock, so there'll be no misunderstanding, why did you use the phrase paid violence? You seem to tie that in with the construction workers in New York.
Well, it's generally alleged that at the end of the week they got the same pay as if they continued at work all week. It is the only possible possible position we may take, because if we had an industry-wide strike, let me refer back to World War II, this industry was out of the automobile business for 4 years and the nation continued on wheels. So that an industry-wide strike would be would continue to the point until it inflicted massive damage on the country and to the point where there was governmental intervention. This we don't want, we don't think the industry wants it. So to avoid that, to keep it in a free competitive atmosphere, after we get the industry position, which will be somewhere along in the third or fourth week of August, we then will make a determination as between the three as to which one we will work to a conclusion of a contract, the economic terms of which will be acceptable, always have been, by the other two. Well, very fortunately, before I became the president, while I was still the director of the General Motors Department, I had met before our convention with all of our General Motors subcouncils, and I had said to them, number one, the Ford Motor Company is not exempt because it had a strike 3 years ago, because if it stood by itself, it would have to face that possibility. The Chrysler Corporation is not exempt because it is in temporary difficulties, because again, if they stood by themselves, they'd have to face that possibility. And the General Motors Corporation is not exempt because it's too big. So that, thankfully, I kept my options wide open.
Is it likely when you do begin negotiations that you might include some of the proposals that the campaign GM had advocated, for example, GM hiring more black dealers, anti-pollution devices? Will that be a central?
Well, that decision we haven't made. We are going to talk to the companies about the question of pollution problems, both in plant and out of plant, the question of the problem of emission control, because that relates directly to collective bargaining. If this industry does not find a proper answer to the question of emission controls and the pollution of the atmosphere, then this society is going to suspend the production of internal combustion engines, which could mean the destruction of our jobs. So we have an immediate interest in the solution of that problem. I might say with regard to campaign GM, I engaged in two elections that day, one for the presidency of the UAW and one to try and get a committee for corporate responsibility in General Motors. I lost one, and I'm glad I won the one I did win. Let me say, I think that development was most unfortunate. As I understand, the release that said that they were refusing a visa to a Soviet labor delegate to come to an affair, an activity of the United Auto Workers at Black Lake in Ottawa, Michigan. The fact is, the United Auto Workers are the host, but the convener of that conference, as you know, is the United Nations. This is a matter that lies between the United States government and the United Nations. As a layman, it's my understanding that the convention, which permitted the United Nations to be housed on American soil, granted to them certain immunities as to the entry of necessary personnel. I am somewhat surprised that there seems to be only one class of personnel who are so barred, namely labor personnel. I can understand why a certain individual may be barred because of his personal past activities inimical to the United States. But this business of denying only a certain class, namely labor representatives, I suppose means either they think they're more red than the Reds, or that we in labor in the United States are more susceptible than businessmen or the farmer out in Iowa who is the host to Chairman Khrushchev. I think it's most regrettable, and I hope it can be reversed, and I certainly hope that the UN conference can go ahead, because the whole question of pollution of the atmosphere, this world being a total system, can only be done on an international basis. Let me add to the one illustration I gave in response to Mrs. Joyce that it had always been axiomatic in the industry that an automobile assembly plant could only operate on a two-shift basis. Some few months ago in Norwood, Ohio, the General Motors Corporation put into effect a third shift. It was widely expected that the third shift would fail, that they wouldn't be able to do it, but every evidence shows that they are going to be able to do it. This means, then, if they can do it in Norwood, they can do it in any assembly plant. Their capital utilization rate will go up. Their capital costs relative to product produced will go down, again relating back to the question of productivity, so that there are many other factors affecting productivity. Now, with regard to the shorter work week, it's been our traditional belief that if we just, for example, sharply shorten the work week and other measures were not taken to prevent what is called moonlighting, the holding of two full-time jobs, which could be readily done by a young, vigorous worker who was required to work only 30, 32 hours in two jobs. He could do it. He does it now sometimes on single jobs. That not only would not meet the problem the nation would be facing of the spreading of work, it would intensify it. So we believe the shortening of working time should be by the additional number of holidays, longer vacations, earlier retirement, and that a society as advanced as ours should lengthen the education period at the beginning of life, lengthen the retirement period more meaningfully at the end of life, and also this question of the Christmas vacation shutdown that the agricultural implement industry has obviously fits right into this concept. If the Christmas time, which is such a great time from a family sense, is unacceptable to the automobile industry because of their need for production in a very prosperous year, then maybe we should do it at some other time. But they should not be allowed to evade that possibility just because they may, on occasion, desperately need that production to meet an expected spring market. Well, let me say this. I said to when I went to Atlanta last Saturday, and at breakfast time I had breakfast with all of our leadership there. I said when I was a local officer, when I became a staff member, I had complete freedom. When I was a regional director, I had almost complete freedom. When I became a vice president, my freedom was sharply curtailed, and I have found now as president I have no freedom at all. Mr. Bluestone, I think, has my schedule as to what I'm going to be doing, and I'm not exactly sure what it is. He tells me as I go from one to the other. Well, the question of the availability of people at the lower end of the seniority list to continue at jobs relates to the tenure of those above them in seniority. And this, of course, goes to the matter of inverse seniority. That is the right of an individual at his own volition to be released from work when there are unemployment periods because he feels he just soon takes some time off and have his income, what he gets under the SUB plan. We have that now, let us say, in General Motors in many locations for the changeover period, which is of limited duration from 3 to 5 weeks. In Ford and in Chrysler, demands were made by the union to make that generally applicable because there had been a lot of core city hiring in both those companies, particularly in Detroit, to allow higher seniority workers who were willing to be laid off to keep at work these hardcore hires. Both companies refused. It can be done. It would take greater financing to the SUB plan, but a few pennies there as against the social risk we run by dumping these people back into hopelessness is little indeed. And we will be pressing that point in these negotiations. Thank you.
John. Hi.